You are listening to Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast.
Swung and lined to deep left field. It is gone! It went deep right. Batista's going to wave goodbye. Start the fireworks show.
This is Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast, episode 128. I'm your host, Matt Lyons, and in this week's episode, Trevor Bauer is now on the Reds. The Indians acquired Franmil Reyes, Yasiel Puig, Logan Allen, and a couple prospects. What does the rotation look like now without Trevor Bauer and with whoever's coming back from the DL and whoever's going back on the DL, speaking of Danny Salazar? Before we get into all that, I want to thank everybody listening live now, or not live, but whenever you listen on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you do. If you're listening, leave us a review, let us know, and join me for all that and more is none other than Mr. Merritt Rolfing. Merritt, how you doing?
You know, it's amazing to think that we, you and I, have done 128 of these episodes. Isn't it amazing? Truly
amazing.
Every
single one. Nobody fact check that. It's been us the whole time.
Listen, there's no point in going
back and
listening.
It's been the Matt and Merritt show from the beginning.
Yeah, no point in listening to old episodes of a baseball podcast. It's all topical stuff. You won't get anything out of it. So
I'm going to start skipping 3 or 4 episodes ahead of time just to see when we're like episode 500 by December and see if anybody notices, and then
I love it.
That's how you build clout, Merritt. You just lie and duplicate your numbers until you're good.
No, exactly. Listen, that's called being good at marketing. Marketing is lying. All right. I mean, that's just facts. Facts is facts, baby.
Now, speaking of marketing, Merritt, we're gonna start with our meatball segment. And you know what podcasts need more than anything, Merritt?
Tell me, Matthew.
They need audio bumpers.
Oh god.
Meatballs.
All right, Merritt, this is our meatball segment now with an audio bumper at the beginning. Maybe the end. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
We'll be delivering
you guys
times.
Some nice meatballs over the plate.
It's disgusting.
So my first one is Yasiel Puig. If he hit a ball, I'd assume if you could hear it, it would sound like that meat slapping sound because he just shreds the ball, as we've seen with the Indians. In his first game, he shreds the cover, Merritt. It sounds like meat. Keep up, would you? Keep up with the meat. Anyway, in his first game, he hit a ball 108 miles per hour. In the second game, he hit one 108 miles per hour. It's ridiculous how hard this guy hits the ball. And we've seen it already. I know one of yours, I won't spoil what it is, but he also has exit velocity the other direction. So it's incredible everything Puig does. Just the general bigness of Puig and Franmil Reyes as well. It's like Puig's 107 was one of the Indians' highest hits of the year. And then Reyes topped it like a little bit later. His was an out. I think both of them were outs. I know Puig's was for sure, and I think Franmil Reyes's was too. And then, I mean, we've seen Puig steal. We saw him get thrown out poorly. We saw him do some fun stuff already. And it's just fun to see. And it since August 1st, Reyes and Puig entering play Sunday. Of the 10 hardest hit balls of the Indians in that span, 5 of them are between Puig and Reyes. So no matter what you think about the trade, it's obvious the Indians got really hard-hitting players, and they've already shown us through Puig and Reyes that they can mash the hell out of the ball. So,
and that, I mean, that I was going to talk about it as one of mine, but since you brought it up, Reyes's first hit as an Indian was insane. When you really go back and watch it, the pitch was basically at his shoulders, which is not a pitch you should be able to A, get any real pad on, or B, be able to do anything to. And it was a ground ball single, you know, that he pulled past his shortstop, but he just hit the hell out of it. And like you said, that's just what they do. They're that if you go onto Baseball Savant and you look at their various graphs, all of Franmil Reyes's batted ball stuff is just jacked all the way to the 99th percentile, basically, and it's truly magical.
And Puig is a little lower now, but I think there might be a little bit of the fact that he was on the Reds. He's an emotional guy, so maybe we can count on the fact that it's a playoff race now and he'll get back to hitting the ball super hard. I don't know. That's just kind of my hope. His is a little bit lower. Like you said, Reyes's is jacked all the way
just,
up.
Just slammed all the way to the, just there's no more room. The man is purpose built to do one thing, and that's just destroy baseballs. And it's fun that he gets to do it with the Indians the next half decade.
So do you have another one besides the one that I stole?
I think the most amazing thing that he did in his debut and has done several times since in what, like 4 or 5 short games. It's what made everyone, one of the many reasons that people went, wow, when he first came to the majors back all those years ago for the Dodgers. But that just, I swear, he threw a ball with his foot against the outfield wall. This was, again, a game against the Astros. The bases were loaded at the time, and Michael Brantley flew out to right field, and he caught on the warning track and threw just, I mean, it wasn't a line shot. It had much more of a it was less of a cruise missile and more of like an ICBM, basically. But it just fired out of his hand and held whoever was at second base from tagging up, which is quite a feat in its own right. Tagging from second to third with when the right fielder has the ball on the warning track should be, you know, a rote thing. You just are able to do that because you can. But instead, no, he was unable to do that because, again, we have a man who is, I'm pretty sure, half missile. He does that with his arm. He does it with the bat. He flies with reckless abandon around the base paths. There's a reason. There's many reasons why Vin Scully nicknamed him the Wild Horse. And this is one of those many reasons. He just has such, I mean, it's that whole last game of the series against the Astros. I thought the Astros did a great job of demonstrating what great outfield defense and the impact of great arms across the outfield can do. Seeing that and also having Naquin in left field and just Mercado's ability to run out and go and get it everywhere is a reminder the Indians can do that now too. And especially with Puig, I mean, that's, I don't have the numbers in front of me. That's got to be one of the five or six best arms in all of baseball when it comes to outfield players. Just incredible. There's nothing better than not even outfield assist, but just but what he does. And you mentioned before we started recording, holding guys to singles on a batted ball to the outfield. That shouldn't happen most times. These guys are great athletes. Not being able to go from first to from home to second on a ball that basically goes to the outfield wall. That's near unheard of.
There's not even a throw on those either. It's the best part. Like, he just has the ball and they know they can't run.
He just winks at them and they go, "Oh, goodness."
Twice against the Angels.
Yeah. So, and like, I mean, granted, if it's Albert Pujols, that's one thing, but like, they have good, very good players there who are athletes and he just bottles them up. It's one of those little things that don't show up in the box score, and having a player like that really, it's nice to see, I guess. It's nice to not see on the other side, too, if that makes sense.
Yes. And it's nice that the couple of throws we saw, I noticed, they did the good camera work where they zoomed it out instead of going straight to where the ball was going. I thought that was good. It seems like whoever's operating, at least a progressive field, they get it. Like, that's how you record an awesome throw. And they've framed it so well every time Puig has thrown it, and it's great, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to give it a sense of perspective. You know, you need to, if anything, pull it out as much as possible so you can really see how far he's throwing it and the ability that he's able to hold guys from doing whatever they're doing.
So my next meatball is another generational talent who goes by the name of Jason Kipnis, who's had a slow season, to say the worst, to say the least so far. Entering play Sunday, he had an 81 WRC+. He slashed .251, .313, .395 with 10 home runs. Not a great season. He started slow. There was a time where I sincerely thought that Brad Miller was going to take over his spot because he just was not good, and Brad Miller was actually looking, I mean, he could hit a couple home runs, and they eventually just got rid of him because they didn't need him, because Kipnis was hitting well at one point, and then he dipped again, and then he got well again, then he dipped again, and now he's on a really good streak. Going back to July 4th was just kind of arbitrary, a month from this recording. He has 108 WRC+ in that span. He's batting .287, .354, .471, so he's doing a lot better. He's back to, I don't know if this is quite peak Jason Kipnis, but this is at least effective Jason Kipnis, which, considering he's no longer the cleanup batter, he's like the seventh or eighth. That's a huge upgrade for what they have. And I was looking at Baseball Savant has these new, what they call rolling window leaderboards, which are really cool. They show basically the trend of expected WOBA, which is based on your, it takes exit velocity, launch angle, and depending on the type of hit, it takes your speed. Like, if it's a dribbler, you should be expected to beat that out if you're fast enough. And then it calculates what your WOBA should be based on all that, as opposed to what actually it is. It takes out bad luck and that kind of thing. And over the last 50 plate appearances, Kipnis is the eighth best trending player, meaning over his last 50 compared to the 50 before that, he's the eighth best in terms of how much he's improved, which is a big thing that shows that just and how he's approaching and hitting the ball alone has dramatically went up for him, regardless of any luck that happens or any kind of other things that we can't quite see. So there's clearly something going on that he's found the stroke for a little while. I believe earlier this season at one point we thought he did, and then it kind of faded, but maybe this drop in the lineup will be good for him if there's some mental thing there. But I don't know, it's just fun that Jason Kipnis is the seventh or eighth hitter now, and he's not terrible. he's an above average hitter at worst, and maybe a pretty good hitter at best if he can carry it through the rest of the season. And it's going to make the decision maybe at the end of the year not difficult, but there's at least some thought into it now to give him, I think he has a pretty big option coming up, or if it's a qualifying offer, I'm not quite sure.
Well, and it's nice. He turned in. I know he's always talked about how he's not, you know, adhering to the whole launch angle thing and all that crap.
Yeah.
But if you look at any of his numbers, any of like the stat casting numbers from last year, there was definitely a marked, I don't know if it was on by accident or on purpose, there was definitely a marked effort by him to start hitting the ball in the air more. And I don't know if that's finally starting to pay off and he's healthy or whatever, but I mean, we've seen it a few times now where it's a, there's a transition point. You know, I you saw that a little bit with the shortstop on the White Sox.
Tim Anderson?
Tim Anderson, who was not great last year by any stretch of the imagination, but there was definitely an effort by him to start trying to hit the ball up more and you know, just basically, again, kind of not be just a ground ball, you know, your typical ground ball kind of a pitcher. And there was definitely a change in how he hit the ball more. I mean, he was hitting for more, a little more power, a little more this and that, but it just wasn't there. And then this year, of course, he has his massive breakout. You know, he's, and I think he's hurt right now, or he was hurt for a while, but, you know, he's OPS jumped by 125 points or whatever. More, again, more power, more this and more that. He's walking less, but striking out less too. And I wonder if this is just a delayed reaction to that. I mean, it could not be. But again, I remember I wrote about this last year, and I just kind of expected, after I saw dividends pay, a delayed dividend be paid in other guys who were doing a similar thing, I was wondering if there would be a payoff down the road for him. And maybe that's what this is. Maybe it's just a hot streak because he's known for those as well, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, he always seems to have these little mini epiphanies. You remember, like, last year, they're in the whole magazine in a hotel room, and he found his hands, and then he was just terrible again, so... I never seen the note. And it's, so his contract next year is a $16 million option, which is, that is a hefty price for Jason Kipnis. So
they will not pick that up. And I don't know. If they do, they're, it's stupid. Gonna, I'm sorry.
Right. No matter what kind of ending he has, really. I thought it was going to be like a qualifying offer or a little less or something, but that'll be the most he ever makes next season if they pick it up. So Merritt, what's your last meatball?
So I like Oscar Mercado a lot.
Yes, he's so good.
He's so good. I was looking at the trade that they made for him. Last year, what a robbery! Just and this is not my meatball, but it was. Let me look at this real quick.
John Torres,
it was
John Torres can be good, but he's so far down.
Exactly. Yeah, like we're talking about what was it? Connor Capel and John Torres. Neither of which have made any impact on the hopes and dreams of the Cardinals this year. Capel is in Triple A Memphis right now, and he's hitting. I mean, he is hitting, but whether that is something or nothing, I don't know. He did not hit when he was in Double A, so who knows? But it looks so good for the Indians. And I was trying to think of, because, you know, he's a flawed player still. He's only walked, what, like 16 times in 287 plate appearances, which is not ideal. He strikes out a little bit much, you know, 18% basically of the time. He had a home run today as we record this. 1-for-5 with that one dinger. It was the open the scoring for the Indians. He walked once as well. But I got to thinking, like, who is he, right? Like, what is a fair comparison for him? When I say fair, I mean something that makes sense that you can kind of imagine a projected towards. And I realize it's Adam Jones. And I think I feel really good about that. And I realized that, you know, maybe an hour or so ago. Adam Jones, when he was 24... Oscar Mercado's age now hit 284, 325, 442, right around where Mercado is now. Mercado's showing a little bit more power, but, you know, he never walked a lot. He always struck out between like 18 and 20% of the time. Again, a flawed player, a good player, a great defensive outfielder at times, and a key player for a long time for what was a very good Orioles team, like every even year, it seemed like. But, like, you know, They always said, like, who had the most wins, I think, in the American League between the years like 2011 and 2016, and it was the Orioles, followed by the Indians. So I don't know. That makes me feel really good about that pick, because even if either of those guys that they traded for him end up hitting, having an Adam Jones on your team for the next 6 or 8 years, and if you can extend him and, you know, get him through his age 32 season or whatever, you know, when he was 32, you have Adam Jones was hitting very well. He was. Well, 32 was actually his past year. But, you know, through his 29 season, again, he was an above-average hitter. He was hitting 32 home runs a couple times there. That's the kind of player that I would hope to see out of him. If he improves, great. If he learns to take a few more swing or take a few more pitches. I think he's at like 3.5 pitches per plate appearance right now, which isn't a lot by any stretch of the imagination. But if what he is now is the baseline for what we can expect growth off of, hell yeah, man. And that's really cool. It's really cool that they found this player. Like, you don't always find superstars like Jose Ramirez. Sometimes you just find these very good players.
Yeah, and then, like, speaking of Adam Jones, like, think if they signed him this year, if they were the team that did the $3 million deal.
Yeah.
They would have had a better outfielder at the beginning of the year, but now as he's slowly declining, we probably wouldn't have seen, like, either Oscar Mercado at all or Oscar Mercado with consistent playing time, because as much as we were all clamoring for him, he wasn't exactly, like, He was a 129 WRC plus hitter in AAA. So that's like a, you can leave him in the minors if you need to. He wasn't exactly like tearing the door down, but
yeah, he wasn't demanding to be there. Yeah.
Right. But the Indians were just so bad in center field, they had to do something, and they ended up bringing him up, and he's been really good for him. So it's kind of just, it's, I'm not going to use that as, I was not one of the people who wanted Adam Jones. I was happy they didn't get him. This isn't something I can really include in my dunk fest of being excited the Indians didn't do it, but it's just one kind of those things. Like if they had signed him, we probably wouldn't have Oscar Mercado. Like who knows if he doesn't have this season, if he doesn't break out at all, like if this crushes his confidence or the Indians just never end up using him consistently because they didn't get to see what they saw this year because they had to bring him up. But yeah, if he turns into Adam Jones, I mean, like his 2009 through 2017 seasons, like even if you take out that peak where he was super good in 2012, like that many seasons of a above average hitter and a really good defender, that's awesome.
And I mean, you know, even look at the batted ball profiles, are pretty similar. Jones hit a few less line drives than Mercado does, which if anything is a tip in favor of Mercado being an even better player. But you know, it's, you know, it's all, it's still so up in the air. We're still only what half a season into his career. He's already dealt with a slump or two. And we, there's definitely things that we wish he would do more of and do a little bit less of, but that's every single player. You know, I mean, it's, you can find flaws in every single player if you want. Give me an hour and a half. I could probably find a flaw in Mike Trout's game. Maybe.
I mean, at one point it was the strikeouts, but that's gone. So, I mean, what are you going to do?
Exactly, right?
But yeah, I'm sure you can find something. Like, you have to dig down. Like, he doesn't swing well at pitches the bottom outside of the zone in 3-2 counts. There we go. We got it. We found it. That's trash. A sweetness.
Old trash. But
you can always find something, I'm sure.
Old trash trout, they call him. Old trash fish. Yep.
So that'll do it for our meatballs this week. I'll spare you from the intro again.
Hit it, baby.
It's coming for
Let
you.
Let me hear that again.
You want it?
One more time. Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. Meatball, so good. So moving on to our newsest section of the podcast. Of course, the biggest news of the week was Trevor Bauer traded to the Reds in return for Franmil Reyes, Yasiel Puig, Logan Allen, and a couple lower level prospects. Who, by the way, if you want to hear about Allen and the prospects, go ahead and check out Indians on Deck this week. They went way in depth with it, as they always do, looking at the guys Indians brought back. So that was really nice. So we don't have to focus on those guys because we have enough with the two big guys the Indians brought back. But first, I want to mainly talk about like Bauer. We're kind of in a unique position because we didn't get to cover it right away because our pod, they of course traded the day we released the podcast. But now we're a week later where there's some of the fallout that came from it. We can see it and step back from a little bit and see, like, kind of paint the picture of what happened in the last few days leading up to the trade and that kind of stuff. And it was kind of interesting that I'm pretty sure it was on last week's podcast where I said that I didn't think the throwing incident was a big deal at all, either to the Indians or to other teams. I still think it wasn't all really to his trade value. I don't think it affected a whole lot, but it sounds like between Bauer and Tito, there was a lot of tension between them. And this was just the last, the last straw was Tito, or not Tito, but Bauer chucking a ball over the wall. I think Tito yelling, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" was cathartic, and he's something he wanted to yell for a very long time. So he finally got to yell it out in public at him. he did. And it was, if you listen to the A to Z podcast, which has Andre Knott, who's a sideline reporter for STO, he of course has a lot of behind the scenes stuff with him. He was saying that there was one point where Tito went out to supper with, or lunch or something, with Trevor Bauer's dad, and he was trying to get like any way to get through to Bauer because he was just driving him nuts. And then he ended up telling Andre, you know, they say apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Trevor's dad is the fucking tree because they're one and the same. I've heard him talk on other podcasts. Like, they're the same person. If you're trying to get some way to find a crack in Trevor Bauer's armor, you're not going to get it through his dad. They are the same kind of analytical. I was not going to say bone. What's the other word for headed when you're like strong headed, I guess? I don't know. But they're,
bullheaded.
They have their own way they're going to do things. Bullheaded. That's the one. Yeah. But yeah. They're very similar people. So it was a point where it sounded like those two were not going to. It was either trade him or it's not going to work out. I don't know if that, maybe in some way that could affect the value because teams know that, but it sounded like it was just not good. And even compared to like a player that Tito loves, who was Michael Brantley, saying goodbye, there was a post in The Athletic that was a quote from Tito, said, "There are times when it's probably more difficult than others. That's probably safe to say. Last year when we talked to Brantley in his exit meeting, there wasn't a dry eye, his or ours. Sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it's not quite as emotional." That's just being honest. So by all accounts, it sounded like they just said, "Trevor, you're traded, bye." Like, all the reports just said it was quick, it was over. He already knew he was traded by that point from his agent. So yeah, it seems like there was more behind the scenes, maybe not quite drama, but more tension than I think a lot of us, or me, I can just say me, didn't give credit to because I didn't think it would matter all that much. I thought maybe Tito just let him do his own thing and it didn't matter, but it sounded like Bauer really got annoyed. Tito, maybe even his teammates, there was talk like he would smash his own things and even his teammates' property, like when he was frustrated, which that's kind of crossing a line. You could be mad and pissy to yourself all you want, but don't be breaking shit. So yeah, we'll start with that, the whole aspect of Bauer and Tito and just Bauer's impact on the clubhouse, which I don't know. Did you see that coming? Like, did you think that it was that much behind the scenes, or were you kind of like following more of the Clevenger Bieber, like he's such a great teammate and they obviously love him, he's helping the pitching staff kind of thing?
I mean, I always thought there was some thing, like you said, he's always seemed like a kind of a tough guy to get along with. I don't know. This is one of the reasons why I hate access journalism. I know he works for either the team or the network that broadcasts them, one of the two, but I hate when journalists like Andre Knott or whoever are like, yeah, man, there's way more going on back here. We'll never tell you. And I'm like, this is stupid. What do I care then? Why even mention it ever? Like, mentioning a thing like that doesn't do any good. It makes me and you, two outsider podcasters, have to talk about it from, you know, weird angles. Now, all that being said, let me talk about it.
Well, I was going to say...
go ahead.
No, one quick thing to that is I agree in general. I think that's terrible, but I think Andre Knott does better than most in that he says that because he's already going way further than he probably either should or has to. Like, there's nobody else that would probably tell you about this tension between Bauer and Tito. And he also said that, like, when Bauer was traded, his exact quote was, Andre is, I'm going to fucking Cincinnati of all places. Like, that's a terrible thing if that got to Cincinnati media. Like, the fact that he said that, I think he does better. Andre Knott is really good about telling us things as far as he can, but he always hits that point where there's more that he can't tell us, which is
I agree with
a lot
you.
Of like, others.
Like Tom Hamilton does that too by not saying things outright, but you can, if you really pay attention, you can read between the lines with a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
I just hate having to do that. That's all. Just like it'd be nice if we knew what was going on. I mean, granted, then I don't know. I mean, do I want people reporting every little thing about what I do in my day to day life? No one wants to see that anyway. It's boring, but still. That all being said, I don't know. It makes perfect sense that someone like Terry Francona would clash heavily with Trevor Bauer, and over time it would just snowball into a real issue, because Terry Francona is an old school baseball type of a guy and Trevor Bauer is anything but. It's a little frustrating in a way that him quote unquote doing his thing, I don't know what that means. You know what I mean? Like, is it just the smashing crap and stuff, that all the bad stuff, or is it also his like disagreeing with pitching coaches and doing things like do we know if his taking, you know, Clevenger aside and showing him the, you know, his flaws and the pitching coach didn't, did this rub Tito the wrong way? And we don't know any of this stuff at all.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of college football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Yeah, it's a huge difference between if the problem was his analytical stuff or his teammate property destroying. It's a very important distinction we didn't get to hear.
And it would be nice if we heard more about this sort of, I don't know if I really care actually about quote unquote palace intrigue within the clubhouse, like what clicks is what and who's getting along with who and all that sort of stuff. We always hear the, you know, the sweet good stuff, like Mike Napoli taking Jose Ramirez under his wing, and you know, Juan Uribe doing the same thing with Ramirez and all this sort of stuff, or Lindor going into the meeting with Yandy Diaz with Terry Francona. We don't hear the bad stuff, which is probably fair, but that's part of the problem too, I think, is that we don't hear about this stuff. So sometimes we get surprised when a trade happens, like when they trade Trevor Bauer, and it's about more than just money, basically.
I care as far as if the problem was the analytical stuff, if like Tito had a problem with that, that he wasn't doing just what his pitching coach said. Because if he really helped Bieber and Clevenger as much as he did, and I don't know if Bieber and Clevenger would be as bullheaded as Trevor was about doing it his way. Like if Carl Willis is trying to tell them different things, and like, you know, they have this information they can help other pitchers coming up, and they're not able to just force their way into doing it like Trevor did, that's kind of a concern. I think I don't care about the drama of the clubhouse either all that much, other than it's interesting sometimes to know what's going on, that's the only thing I'm concerned about, is if Tito and the rest of the coaching staff is not on board with analytics. But I'd assume at this point they are.
They have to be. It's just, you know, literally they have to be, because if they aren't, then the Indians aren't gonna be any good. But I guess being unable to communicate that stuff is would be a knock. Again, we're all just doing lots of would possibly and maybe here. I don't know. What do you think that throwing the ball over the fence really had that much of an impact? That the Indians really needed outfielders, and he had an opportunity to get Franmil Reyes and Yasiel Puig in addition to those prospects, at least one of which I think is going to be pretty good for Trevor Bauer.
I think that's
a deal you have to make. I think it's 100 times out of 100 kind of deal. It's a deal we've all been demanding for the last 2 years. And they have all this pitching staff talent, and they're ass in so many other aspects of the team. Like, use the strength you have, reduce it a little bit, and because it doesn't all matter that much in the playoff, you don't need five ace starting pitchers really. So I don't know.
They got a phenomenal deal for him, so I don't think it matters. Yeah. Like, in that sense, is that if he was an angel or terrible, like if you get this deal, you take it. But I think it matters in the fact that, like, it sounded like it was Tito didn't like him very much anymore because of everything. Yes. And then doing something like this in public, it sounds like this was a manifestation of all the stuff he's done behind the scenes. And like to have it out in public now really annoyed Tito more than anything, that this guy who can't seem to keep his shit under control is now doing it on the field. And he even said like he had problems reeling everybody back in after it happened in the game itself. Because if you remember, the Indians sort of almost had a comeback a little bit, and then it sort of faded.
But
it's not like that was a bigger distraction than we might think. And it was also after he was traded, he came back and he was just in the crowd. He was just standing there watching. And then he had his own press conference that he took everybody to the cafeteria and just answered his own questions. Like, and that I thought would be nothing. But then again, from Andre, it sounded like the players, it didn't sit well with some of them, that it wasn't all, like, it makes sense. It's an all Trevor thing. They're taking away from the game that they're working for and doing right now while he's parading around and answering questions in a cafeteria, just because, which serves nothing for the Indians. It's all Trevor, which
It's a side of I listened to that podcast. It's a side of Trevor Bauer I never really thought about. He always seemed not so much self-centered in a way that he's more what's the word I'm looking for here? I don't know, like kind of a insular, I guess. He doesn't spend time thinking about other people because he's so focused on his own success. Because as we've talked about before, Trevor Bauer has been forged by his own efforts. He's not the specimen that some of these guys are. He's put the work in to turn into something greater than I guess he was destined to be based on his physical gifts alone. So I never really thought about him being some sort of borderline prima donna. But then again, like you said, the way Andre now talked, it made it sound like it was something like that. So I don't know. I saw that tweet that Zach Mizell sent. I was like, Trevor Bauer's here. Here's a photo in the crowd. I'm like, oh, that's strange. That's a little bit silly. But I didn't really think anything else of it. I thought maybe he was just checking out the game one last time before he was leaving. But then the fact that he turned into a whole media thing, that was a little bit lame.
Yeah. And the last thing, I think I'm kind of, I don't know about connecting dots that may or may not be there. But so his apology, everybody commended it after the throwing the ball thing, that it was very sincere and there wasn't dancing around it or anything. But also in the Andre conversation, it sounded like Trevor didn't quite get everybody was so pissed off about it because he said he thought it was fine. And like, I should have listened again to get that quote, but it was basically like Andre had to explain to him, like, this is why you fucked up and why it's so bad. So I think like Trevor's apology, it shows how easy it is to do that when you don't have an ego about baseball or about like, no, he has an ego about baseball. He doesn't have an ego about, I don't know what way to describe it.
Public perception, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Cause if you cared about like being this big tough guy, you wouldn't want to apologize. You'd want to say like just bullshit that they always do, but it's super easy just to say that I was wrong and I get it. I hurt my teammates. I shouldn't have done that kind of thing when you don't really care. And I think that's part of what Trevor's thing is that he's really calculating all this, and he knew that's clearly obviously what you're supposed to do. So we did it. And I don't know you can still commend him for doing it. I just don't know if it was sincere as everybody sort of thought up front, because it's just sort of, he took the PR-ness out of it and just said what you were supposed to, which most people don't do because they care so much about like crafting this perfect apology that toes the line between not giving yourself too much blame or what. But he just took the route that's the most obvious, is just putting all the blame on yourself and move on, and then you're done. So I don't even know if that makes it more or less sincere or just more or less calculating in the way that makes sense so you can get on with it, even if you don't agree with it. So we can move on to what the Indians actually got back, which was, of course, Franmil Reyes, Yasiel Puig, Logan Allen, and a couple of prospects. Logan Allen, I think, is a pretty underrated part of it. He's a big lefty who, he was hitting 95 in AAA, and he maxed out at 96. He wasn't very good for the Padres this year, but he has a chance to be something, I think.
I think he's the second biggest piece of the trade.
Franmil Reyes is going to be around. Second beat? No, well, yeah, because Puig's going to be gone. So
yeah, exactly. I think Puig is borderline a throw-in on this trade, honestly. Like, this is a move.
Well, with the value of rentals, I mean, yeah, it's not that big of a... he's a below-average hitter to this point, and nobody wants rentals anymore. So, yeah, I agree with that. He's a throw-in. It's just a more exciting throw-in than usual.
Without a doubt. You couldn't have a more exciting throw-in than Yasiel Puig. Oh, no doubt about it. It just makes me think back to... it was 2012. The Indians made a three-team deal that involved the Reds, and they ended up with Trevor Bauer and Brian Shaw. And I thought, and Matt Albers. That turned out pretty great for them. They lost Shin-Soo Chu in that deal. They also ended up with Drew Stubbs somehow. So it's just interesting to see them make another deal with their southern neighbors that is supposed to, at least, be this, once again, franchise-shaping deal. Because getting a Trevor Bauer, who, again, turned into a borderline ace for them for a while, and was probably their ace for a bit this year. I don't know. What is an ace? Who knows? But that was Brian Shaw, also, of course, a central piece in one of the best bullpens ever constructed in 2016. So if they can turn this into Franmil Reyes being some sort of god at the plate, and then also Logan Allen being the first left-handed starter of any value they've had since Cliff Go Lee, on, I guess. Too. Cliff Lee, I would say, honestly, would be. Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it goes Cliff Lee, and then it goes like
CC, yeah,
Mitch Talbot or something. if you go after Cliff Lee, like the years post Cliff Lee when it comes to lefties for the Indians was harrowing, to say the least.
Yeah,
but this is the kind of deal that you expect the Indians to make. They're frustrating deals in a way because they didn't. And I don't know if you read that article that David Roth wrote in Deadspin about how everyone is behaving like the Mets except the Astros because they're trying to construct teams that are just good enough to get to the playoffs and hope everything works out for the best. And that is kind of what this deal is. You're dumping a proven product for what is still a whole bunch of potential. And if it all works out well, then you're on easy street. But if it doesn't, then obviously you're F'd in the A, as it were.
Now wait, does Roth actually prove that that's... I didn't read that. I saw you posted. I should have read it. But does he prove that it doesn't work? Because
no,
that's
not
what
at
the
all. No,
are doing,
he,
and
no.
I think that's not...
No,
terrible.
No, no. He's not proving that he's not saying it doesn't work. He's just saying that it's a stupid way of building a team that only enriches the owners, basically, is what it is. It's a method the owners are using to continue to tamp down money, and it's a long-term kind of trickery that has been played upon fans to not expect teams to really go all out for things. And
well, I mean, what's going all out though? It doesn't do you that much.
Have you,
is
did,
my point.
Did like, you see what the Astros did? Did you see what the Astros
did? They win
did?
A World Series yet with it though?
Oh my God, Matt, are you kidding me?
No, I'm saying like it doesn't move. You don't win just because you got a big trade deadline acquisition. That's not a thing.
No,
if you just get into the playoffs and get hot, you can win.
It's not just a single trade deadline though. It's the fact that the Indians again didn't re-sign Michael Brantley and went through half a season now with dead bodies in the outfield. They could have spent money. They didn't. Instead, the Astros did, and they gave Michael Brantley a comparative pittance for what he is worth. And now
they
have
still might make the playoffs. Now you're skipping that part. They still might make the playoffs, and they could still win the World Series.
You're 100% right. And if everything goes right and they get a little bit lucky in the playoffs, then they could win a World Series. If everything goes normally for the Astros, if they have hiccups, they are well placed to at least appear in a World Series and go up against another team that also, well, they do a different way, the Dodgers, I mean. But all I'm saying is his whole point was the teams are, by and large, behaving as though control is more valuable than actual proven talent.
Oh, yeah, I don't like that. Like that stupid quote the Blue Jays had.
Right, exactly. Well, and he quotes that guy. Yeah, we turned 7 years of control into 42. And I'm like, yeah, great. What does that do for me? And the Indians did turn a year and a half of control into a ton, basically. I mean, if you just go with Allen and Reyes, that's, 11 years of control, basically. So, which is, again, nice. And they have all the other little guys, too. But that all being said, I like the deal because they dealt from a position of strength. And again, when you're talking about the Mets, it's different than talking about the Indians, I think. The Mets are simply a small market team that happens to play in a big market, and they should have more resources than they do. The Indians don't have these benefits. So
the Mets also don't know what the fuck they're doing. That's another...
that's another terrible. That's another thing, too. They're also poorly run, but they keep on pulling these teams together. So you have an 85-win team, and if it all breaks right, then you have a 95-win team. The Indians have lucked out a lot the last several years. We can both agree on that. So they're having a shot now looks more like them having a 98 win team because they lucked into Lindor and Ramirez and that entire pitching staff. And
I mean, I don't know. That was... Can you say they lucked in the players they drafted and signed and traded for?
And then they also
build a team.
Well, they lucked into them and that they developed. First of all, what are we talking about? Jose Ramirez, like that was that. And you're right. Maybe
they developed
luck,
him,
but sure they did. But like this was not supposed to happen, and it was. I don't know. All I'm saying is they've been a very lucky team in all things considered. Why aren't other teams developing a Shane Bieber or a Mike Clevenger? You know what I mean? Where are other teams? How many teams are?
I mean, if it was luck, wouldn't more that pop up more often? That teams just, I guess, sort of the Mets did it a few years ago. But if it was pure luck, wouldn't it just be that this happens more often than the Indians have this stream of pitchers that seem to be great consistently? It seems like somewhere along the line they've done something right.
Right. No, I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. I think that they are doing something right. We don't know what it is per se, but they've also gotten lucky with the lack of injuries up until this year and things of that nature too. And things. Guys maxing out, I guess. And that doesn't always happen. And maybe that is a developmental thing. You draft the right guy. We always hear about makeup and stuff, too. So maybe I am poo-pooing the Indians' ability to draft personality-wise a little bit. But
I think that the trade thing is the biggest one. Like, all the teams they rip off and get these guys that are...
Yes.
Because they're not trading for a lot of, like, low-A guys. They're getting guys who are, like, double and triple-A who are about to come up so they can keep... Like rapidly refilling their team is what they're doing now. For a while, they got like Klubers and Santanas and Carrascos, and got all these great trades that they do really well, which is beyond luck. I guess maybe that's it's hard to tell what's luck and what's them actually knowing what they're doing. They did have bad luck, are they just the Mets? I don't know.
I think there's a little bit of luck to be had in who they. Well, maybe it's not luck; it's identifying weak points in other teams. Like for instance, the Reds, their general manager trying to keep his job and, you know, make a push for the playoffs this year because they've been rebuilding for a while now and their ownership's probably getting a little bit antsy, and they're able to leverage that into Franmil Reyes because they can turn this 3-team deal into something. That and also, of course, they have their fingers everywhere because, you know, the Indians front office has been a breeding ground for executives across baseball now at this point. If you didn't work for the Indians, basically you worked for the Red Sox at some point. Or
the Astros,
I suppose. Or the Astros, basically, yeah. So, well, even the Astros
are getting there.
Well, the Astros, you can draw a line directly back to the Cardinals too, because Lunau worked for the Cardinals, didn't Walt Jocketty work for the Cardinals too before he went over the Reds? So that's really those are the three main trees, I suppose. Cardinals,
you can
Indians,
draw lines from the Cardinals back to the Astros to their database, and then you can do that.
Well, true, it's a big old circle, I suppose, a happy circle of achievement,
happy circle of crime.
Yeah, hey. That was some neat crime. Let's be honest here. It was hilarious.
It was, yeah.
Because the password was like password or something like that.
As far as the trades and the...
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say there's no more Stooges left is the big thing. Like it's the Indians, Astros, and Rays who seem to be like, if you trade with them, you're going to lose. And the Astros we just saw with Aaron Sanchez, they just had him throw more curveballs and now he's amazing-er than before.
Right.
Well, so it seems like there's going to be fewer and fewer teams that they can just rip off, and I'll be interested to see how they can handle that and if they can still be as good as they are.
Well, I don't think that they pulled the wool over the eyes of the Reds necessarily. I think, again, I think there was a weakness there in the Reds, you know, kind of power structure and stuff like that of a team trying to hold on to a tenuous grip at a playoff spot and show some legitimate growth after, you know, several years in the wilderness. Because how long have the Reds been rebuilding now at this point, would you say? 3.5, 3 years, 4 years now?
What's tomorrow? August 5th? 70 years, 70, 75 years? No, I don't, it's been a fucking long while. They haven't been good since like the middle, fuck. When were they good?
When was the
early 2010s,
like it
right?
Wasn't all that long ago. Yeah, I know they lost that series to the Giants in 2013. But before that, it's what do we got?
That was like the start of the end, if not the tail end, was 2013.
I think that was kind of the death knell. Yeah. So they've been bad.
Right. You can trace it with Bronson Arroyo, basically. Just follow him, and that's where they go.
2015 was their first time in last place. They were in fourth the year before that. So they were first place team in 2012, then third, fourth, fifth, fourth now. So yeah, they've been ostensibly you could call it rebuilding for 5 years, and that's too long. That at that point is just too many years spent being bad and them not cashing in and turning into something. So the Indians
they've done worse and like half-assing it, and
right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, like they try and paper it over, and that's what happens sometimes when you don't have a front office that has a firm grasp on things and a clear vision too. And I think the Indians at least have that benefit of having a consistent line running all the way back basically to Mike Hart when during the move over to Progressive Field. The Reds don't really have that so much with their new management and all this. Like, they had Walt Jocketty for a while, but that all fell apart. Who's the general? Dick Williams has been there for a while now, and he just needs to show some improvement. So when you do that, sometimes you make a rash decision. That was trading away one of their top prospects, and the Indians were able to take advantage of that and turn that into something else. So I think that might be the new what would you call that? A market inefficiency they're able paradigm? To exploit.
Oh yeah.
Or paradigm, sure. Their ability to take advantage of people showing weakness. Basically, that's what they're going to start doing. And we're going to get more and more uncomfortable with it. So, yeah.
And I would propose to you and David Roth that, the Reds doing this in the offseason, signing Derek Dietrich and trading for Yasiel Puig, like that's what people want, right? They spent a bunch of money. They got a bunch of players. And look how it turned out. And then, like, a couple of years ago, there was the Padres that did that. Like, you can't just go nothing and grab a bunch and be good. And I don't know if
you're
being
right,
really good and adding more does much.
But going, the Indians haven't been going from nothing since 2015 now, have they? They've had a stacked rotation, and they've had at least one MVP candidate in playing for them. And then, once again, for $32 million, they could have had a man who is currently hitting 320, 379, 516, and that's after he went like 0 for whatever with the against the Indians a couple days ago. He would be the second best hitter on the Indians. I think I mentioned it in an earlier podcast that there would have been four or five Indians players, or there are four or five former Indians from last year that would all have been better than every single hitter on the Indians right now playing elsewhere in baseball right now. Now that would mean they wouldn't have Carlos Santana, which would suck. But if they could have Carlos Santana still Edwin Encarnacion and Michael Brantley, then we wouldn't have had 2.5 months of heartache, basically. And we're fixing that now. They're fixing that now by trading away Trevor Bauer, but not having to do that and have a more of a behemoth, more of a juggernaut, and, you know, make moves that actually have an impact for the whole season rather than just in the second half, and also hope for a couple weird hot streaks like the Indians had. I think that's better for us as fans than what they did.
Now, Merritt, when they could have spent, they could have got Michael Brantley, or they could have spent $4.5 million on Danny Salazar, which they did.
Damn, dude.
Brings
damn.
Us to our next great topic of good Lord, Danny Salazar. That was a waste of fucking money. He pitched 4 innings. He came back finally from his numerous arm injuries. He looked awful. Like, not even just his stats. He just
looked
bad.
Physically awful. He looked bad.
He looked ill. Like, he was. Zach Meisel said that a good point, that it just doesn't look max effort. Like, you see players like Trevor Bauer, Mike Clevenger pitch, where they're just like, ugh! And they're fully into it. And Daniel's just like lobbing the balls up there. And
he looked a little bit out of shape. Like, you just, I don't know, man. Like,
it was weird. The hair was great. It was on point. The beard was good, but there was something off.
It looked like a little bit of a beard. Maybe his jersey was just a little bit baggy. We're used to him wearing he used to wear much tighter clothes, basically. And he just looked a little bit sloppy, I suppose. I watched it, I was like,
is that how we fix him? We tighten up his clothes a bit?
I guess
that
so.
Leads
yeah,
the velocity.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's the drag.
Yeah. God, you look terrible.
Yeah, he topped out at, what was the top? Like 88.9, and he
89,
barely struggled to get that.
Oh, God. He looked so terrible. Curveball is good.
Well, sure, if you can differentiate in front of his fastball.
74 mile an hour
curveball.
Statcast
didn't know what his slider was. And then,
no.
Like, there were reports that he was a 92-93, and if he could stay that with his changeup, maybe you can make it work. But if he can't hit 87 consistently, he's done. I would be shocked if he pitches again for the Indians this season.
There's
like
no
they
point
said he's not even working out
point.
With the team. Right, yeah. Like, this was your chance to get him back in enough time to be good for the playoffs, and you missed that window.
Like, I prefer to see Plesac, or maybe not Plesac. I can't do that. Savale would be fine. Yepy Rodriguez, if he can make it back. I'd prefer to see any of these guys, even if none of them could seem to get strikeouts. All of them have, weirdly, all those young guys have a weirdly very similar strikeout rate, and it's confusing to me, to say the least. But Danny looked so bad, and I mean, it had to happen, I guess, like, that we needed to see him pitch this year. The most expensive, worst. Was that the most expensive four innings ever? Maybe.
Well, that has to be.
Million.
If you prorate that out, if he got paid that
million,
much for four innings,
million two
like
per
a billion
inning.
Dollar contract.
Actually,
it's not great,
out.
Bob.
How, How many innings? Let's see. Calculator, help me out here. 1.2 times 200. That's a $240 million a year contract. Let's figure that over 5 years. There we go.
That's $1 billion.
That's a $1.2 billion contract.
For a guy that can't throw 89. You did it, Indian. Right, so you did a good job.
How many wins above replacement would you have to earn for that to be a valuable contract? Let's see. You figure $8.5 million per win on average on the free agent market. 28.2 wins above replacement. I did that in a video game once with a second baseman. I had 108 home runs.
You got to be a two-way player at that point. Right.
Yes, 100%. You'd have to pitch every... All right. Well, when he was with the... Let me think about this. When he was with the Brewers, CC Sabathia, how much was he worth when he was pitching every like third day, basically? That was... Where are you? Damn it. It won't separate it out for me. Stupid fan graphs. I'm going to have to use baseball reference. CC Sabathia. We're doing baseball stuff here, folks. I'm looking up stats even as we talk. Remember CC Lee? Let's talk about that while I try and find these numbers. All right. So he was worth 3.9 wins above replacement in 17 games. I don't even know how to do that math. I don't know. I'm not really sure. He threw like 250
innings that year.
It's a lot.
That's the other thing. That's what we're getting at.
I believe basically the combo is an ass load of innings is how many he'd have to pitch.
We've run the numbers. It's an ass load.
Yeah. We figured it out, boys. Either way, it's we not cracked the code. Yeah. Shit loads. That's how many innings he had to throw. 400 innings or something. He'd have to throw a third of the season. Basically, what was Charles Radbourne worth when he was pitching every single old Hoss Radbourne? He started 60 games. No, I'm sorry. He started 75 games in 1884, and he was worth 19.
Wow, he pitched 500 innings for the Bean Eaters.
It's 678 innings in 1884.
Wow. Still only 9.5 wins.
God damn. So lots and shitloads, basically.
Shitloads. Yeah. That's what we're doing at. It's not good. But yeah, it's so put a percent on it. What do you think the chances are we see our boy Danny Salazar anywhere with the Indians this season?
There's no point in it, right? Like there's literally no point in it. Just give him the money, let him go have a nice vacation.
Yeah, and I mean, they're not even sending him to Arizona. Like they said, Terry Francona in the pregame show said that he was telling Danny, we're out of room down there, so you can just go home and come back when you're feeling good. Which that is not That's what hilarious. You say to a star pitcher when you want him to come back.
You know, between that and like the things that and his attitude towards like Trevor Bauer and stuff, I think Tito's a bit more prickly than I give him credit for. He seems like just a saucy old guy. Jeez. I mean,
he has a tomato sauce, so.
That's true. You think about that.
It is. That's where the saucy comes from. Yeah, I think that's part of his charm too for a lot of people. Probably is that he's snarky. Maybe is that he's so prickly. Snarky. I guess it's just the thing. Like some people, it's endearing to
snarky
a lot of
and a little bit. He's a little bit. He's a straight shooter, basically.
Yeah. No, and when you're a guy that he likes, I'm sure he's like to Brantley. He's just probably a big cuddly bear to him. So.
Oh, I definitely am.
That's probably good.
So, it's nice to see it happen because we needed to see evidence of him existing.
Now we can never see it again.
This was definitely the worst possible outcome. And now it's happened and we can move on with our life.
Is that the single weirdest night in a long... I can't think of like a weirder outing or something for a player for the Indians in a long while. I don't think it'll be remembered for that because it wasn't like big and flashy, but like seeing the radar gun constantly be 87, everybody just freaking the hell out at once was pretty, that was something cool to be a part of in a way, is I don't think we'll see something quite like that again.
If it had happened in Cleveland, I think Corey Kluber breaking his arm earlier this year probably would have been a weirder time.
Oh, yeah, when he tried to flip the ball.
In a way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is probably the weirdest one, just because, what the fuck? Like, that's what it's just... Like I said before, it couldn't have gone worse. There's zero.
It literally could not have gone any worse. I can say that word now and mean it.
So it's nice that we've seen that, I suppose. You know, like we've seen the absolute bottom of the well, and all that's down there is $4.5 million and an arm that can't throw over 90. And that's not even Josh Tomlin. It's not even Josh Tomlin this time.
All right, Merritt, that's going to do it for our show this week. If you're still listening now,
I'll say this one last thing. I'm sorry. Uh-oh. I love listening to Rick Manning when things are going really bad for the Indians, like when something fucked up like that is happening. Because you can hear him going, you can hear in his voice going, oh, crap, this is really bad. He's like, it's just, like I remember when Carlos Carrasco was, every now and then he'd have that weird hitch where he'd start throwing the ball over to like first base.
He just got stuck doing that, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, what is Carrasco doing out there? It's just
when he just doesn't know what to do with himself. It's great.
Once it gets sideways, Rick just kind of starts freaking out, and I love it. And that was just from the get go. I turned that game on, and I went to the bathroom real quick, and I came out and was already 1-0. I went, ah, crap! And then I saw the speed gun. I was like, oh no, devil no! So yeah, that was my reaction. Great time, yeah. Great time. Anyway, that's all.
All right, Matt. So we'll talk to you next week, and maybe we won't have any more Danny Salazar collapses. So maybe we will. Who knows? See you then.